waiting for the stragglers. I know a few years back there used to be a running team called the Stragglers from my home city where I was born in Pietermaritzburg, and I suppose they're still around. But I wasn't aware we had stragglers on the committee. Anyway, but I'm just waiting for them to get here. In that interim period, we informally were discussing this whole issue of how do we talk to each other on these critical issues. And I think I ended up the last session on this note. And there is a need on the one hand for total transparency, but also in respect of modelling. There's modelling and modelling and modelling, as we all know. And, you know, there used to be a sort of a joke about stats. Tell me what it is you want to prove and I'll give you the stats. And the same applies to modelling, in fact. What do you want? I'll give you the model. And that applies to those in the on the fashion ramp as well as anywhere else. Now, at least I see two members here and a third of our support staff sitting at the back there. And a fourth. And a fifth. There we are. And I would like immediately then to turn to Silicon. And on that particular note, just to... I think you've probably seen, you've been here a long time then, Mr. Morkel, is it? So you're aware of how we want to move. You're now more aware than the others of exactly where the focus is. So do begin. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Stu Morkel. I'm the Managing Director for Silicon Technology. Now, first of all, just want to thank Madam Chair and the Honourable Members for this opportunity to speak here. I'm going to be try to be short and sweet. How do you operate this thing? This thing. I'm used to mouse. Why doesn't it go to the next slide? Do I need to? The arrow key. Ah, got it. Okay, in my presentation, I'm going to give a brief overview of Siltec, as we call it for short, Silicon Technology, shortened to Siltec and Perisilicon, what it is, how it's produced, and where it is used. Obviously, I will also focus on our cost drivers. Again, not trying to play the blaming game or pointing figures, but show what the real impact was of the impact of electricity tariff increases. And the reason I'm using was because Siltec has closed down. I'll get to that later. And then also just revert to the events of the first half, second quarter of this year, and also just coming back a little bit to end of 2010, last year, explaining all the events that have eventually led to us deciding to stop our operation and retrenching our employees. Going on to Silicon Technology, Siltec, who we is and what we do. We are situated in Newcastle, just south of Newcastle, the Northern KZN. This is a picture of our plant. You can see it's in the rural area of Newcastle, of KZN. Fairly small operation in all standards, complement about 270 people, permanent employees employed directly by Siltec. Also another about 120 contractors in various forms that was impacted or employed by the operation. We have the capacity to produce about 50 to 55,000 tons of ferrosilicon per annum. That is really not a large number. If you compare the total global capacity or production capacity for ferrosilicon, is about 7 million tons per annum. Operation itself, we operate two submerged arc furnaces, and I'll show you a picture of what it is just now. Rated at about 27 megawatts for the one furnace, the smaller one. The other one was operated at 31 megawatts. Total consumption in terms of electricity is about 550 gigawatt hours per annum. If you go and compare that to what an average household, small household in South Africa would consume, that equates to about 90 to 100,000 households. So it's a fair amount. And then obviously we also operate the bag houses for fume abatement. There was still a silica fume plant where we captured the fumes and densified, supplied into the brick making into the concrete industry. A small brick making plant where we conglomerated the ferrosilicon fines again to supply into our market. And then also a small recovery plant where we sorted and screened our slag generated on the plant. This is a quick picture. That's the hot end of the furnace. You can see the burden there and also the burden burning. You cannot see it, but there's three electrodes protruding from the top, which introduces the electricity into the burden to let the reaction take place and eventually get the material to tap out at the bottom. That's a typical tapping operation. On the left-hand side, you can just make out the furnace there. Below the very bright sparks there, that's your ladle into which the material is tapped. On the right-hand side, just out of the picture, is the tapper. He's standing behind the tapping screen, and there's also a smoke hood above that, just to capture the fumes. As I said, the material is tapped into a ladle. That's a ladle taken up by the overhead crane just before the casting operation would start, and there's your actual casting operation. It's a fairly crude operation, very much labor intensive, nothing really fancy. What is ferrosilicon? Ferrosilicon is an alloy, one of your ferroalloys. You also get ferrochrome, ferromanganese, and also silicon manganese. Ferrosilicon in particular contains 70 to 75% silicon metal, Si, 20 to 23% iron, and then there's also some impurities dissolved in it, aluminium and calcium being the most important ones. You've seen from our tapping operation, we cast into a bed prepared from ferrosilicon fines, materials left there to cool down for 24 hours, and then it's recovered with a front-end loader, put through a screening and crushing and screening facility, and the end result is basically what you see in the picture there. It's little bricklets almost of solidified metal that is then sold and supplied into our customer base. The application of ferrosilicon is used predominantly in the steel making and the foundry industry. Steel making, both carbon and stainless steel production, uses ferrosilicon in the process, where it finds application both as an alloying element used for deoxidization. It's also an important source of energy in the production of steel. Roughly 70% of the global ferrosilicon output is used in steel. And on average, silicon content is 0.3% for mild steel and 1% for stainless steel. Foundries use another about 20% of global production. We also supply to some customers in Australia that was using it for welding consumables. And then finally, ferrosilicon can also be used in the production of other ferroalloys, notably magnesium and low-carbon ferrochrome, where ferrosilicon particularly is used as a reducting agent. Just a quick overview of what the process entails, and the reason why I'm doing this is just to explain that there's no shortcuts. It's a chemical reaction that takes place. The chemical reaction dictates that a certain amount of input material is used to produce a certain amount of output material, and a certain amount of energy is used in that process, and there's no shortcut in terms of that. In particular, I can just maybe quickly point out that in terms of quartzite is the typical white rock that's often used as decorative stone in gardens. We use about 2 tons of quartzite to produce a ton of ferrosilicon, about 1,500 kilograms of coal or various sources of carbon is used in the process. Some mill coal is used as a source of iron, and then in particular about 9,000 kilowatt hours per ton of electricity used to produce a ton of ferrosilicon. How does our electricity consumption compare to some of the other ferroalloys that's also produced? There's a little chart there on the left that basically highlights that. The ferrosilicon is being the red one there, about 9,000 or 9 megawatt hours per ton, compared to high carbon ferrochrome, which is about 2.7. Ferromanganese, high carbon ferrochrome, or depending on what kind of technology one uses, can vary between 2.2 to about 3.7. Silicon manganese about 4.2, and then you get your ferrosilicon 9 megawatt hours per ton, and silicon metal even more than that, about 11 megawatt hours per ton. So in all due respect, ferrosilicon is a very high consumption or consumer of electricity per unit produced. And they, one could ask the question, is there really place for ferrosilicon production in South Africa anymore? I'm not going to try and answer that. What I do want to say is it's common knowledge in the industry that BHP Billiton has decided to close down their silicon manganese operations in Metalloys in Meyerton. So we're already moving down that curve. It's not only the ferrosilicon producers that are closing down. We're already moving down that curve. Silicon manganese has closed down us again. And Microsoft earlier demonstrated that China's already a larger producer of ferrochrome than what South Africa is. Who are our customers? Just before we closed down last year in full operation, 2011, we were exporting roughly 60% of our production, and 40% of that was sold locally. Looking at the local consumers of our product, ArcelorMittal being about 15%, Columbus consuming about 8%, various smaller other consumers in South Africa each taking about 3 to 5%. Then the export market, we were supplying about 30% of our product into Europe. Glencore is our holding company, and they acted as our agent in Europe, so we were supplying ArcelorMittal in Europe, Voestalpine in Austria, and a couple of other consumers there as well. We also had a large portion of the market in Australia, where we were supplying BlueScope Steel and One Steel as some of our customers there. 9% of our production typically went to Japan, and then another 4% to the Middle East, where we're supplying the aluminium industry, Jubal and Emol aluminium smelters in the Emirates. How has our customer base changed over the last couple of years? Again, I've tried to use the same kind of color scheme there, with the brownish ones or the reddish ones are local customers, and the bluish ones export. You can see there over the past couple of years there has been a remarkable change in how the material was spread and distributed between various customers. In 2006 and 2007, before the global financial crisis, roughly 60% of our product was supplied locally in South Africa to local consumers. And then that declined to about 30% in 2011. The reasons for that being various factors. Obviously, I think the economy has had some impact on the operations of ArcelorMittal and Columbus. There's also been some replacement with other products. And in particular, in 2011 as well, we started to see that imports are starting to make inroads on our customer base locally. Going on to our cost drivers, what is driving the cost of electricity, similar graph to what we've seen with the foundry industry. Again, this is a total absorbed costing model that I've used here with all costs, also overheads absorbed into the model here. Ferrosilicon is used as is sold per ton, so the cost distribution is here displayed on a per ton basis. In our case, electricity, and this is based on cost of production for 2012, had we been in production this year. Cost of electricity would have made up 43% of our total production cost. Included in there is all the charges related to the cost of electricity. Maximum demand charges, which is really the charges that we pay to Eskom just to make the allocation available to us. And we even continue to pay that whether we use and consume electricity or not. As we are standing now, our operation is suspended. It's been in suspension since the beginning of February. We've been paying R1 million a month just to keep that allocation there. At the moment we give up that allocation, we will forfeit it and we will not be able to get it back. Then active energy charges, that is what we pay per kilowatt hour consumed. And our cost is, we are supplied in terms of the Megaflex time of use urban tariff scheme. So there's peak tariffs and off-peak tariffs and winter tariffs and summer tariffs. You might be familiar with it. We're a 24/7 operation, so our cost of electricity equates to about 33-34 cents per kilowatt hour in summertime, and about 64 cents per kilowatt hour in wintertime. All included in there is also admin charges, and then we get to rural subsidies and environmental levies. Now, the rural subsidies is about 4.5 cents per kilowatt hour, and environmental levy is another 3.5 cents per kilowatt hour. So in terms of taxes and additional taxes and levies that we paid, that we are paying over and above our normal consumption, it's about 8 cents per kilowatt hour that we have to pay. Our average electricity cost is about 42, weighted average cost is about 42 cents per kilowatt hour. So there's another 20%, literally you can call it a tax, over and above the cost of electricity for us. Raw materials makes up about 30% of our production cost, labor 11%, consumables, which include the electrode casings, the refractories that we use, is about 5%, and then fixed costs, which includes administrative charges, maintenance, environmental expenses, those are only 10%. So on a rand per ton ferrosilicon produced, if you want to try and see where can you cut to reduce your cost and stay competitive, you get to a point where almost 80 or 90% of your cost is fixed. As I said earlier, it's a chemical reaction that takes place. You need a certain amount of raw materials to produce the unit of ferrosilicon. You need a certain amount of electricity to do that. And we all know that labor, there's not much that you can do about labor. 80 to 90% of our cost is fixed. There's nothing that you can do about it on a rand per ton ferrosilicon produced basis. How has electricity impacted on our tariffs in the past couple of years? Before I get to the chart on that, just quickly illustrate what kind of increases Siltec has seen in terms of electricity tariff tariffs. And the two yellow lines are the important ones there. You can see that I've used 2007 as our base, and we've seen those really exorbitant increases in 2008 to 2012, 25.9% in 2008, 31% in 2009, 32% in 2010, 27% in 2011, and 16.9% in 2012. Cumulatively, that equates to an increase of 224% over the past 5 years, which really means that the cost of electricity for our operation has tripled. So you can see what kind of impact that has been. In terms of our cost of production, total cost of production has doubled, increase of 114% between 2007 to 2012. You've already seen the slide. Mike has had it on his presentation as well, how the cost of electricity in South Africa has changed compared to Western world silicon producers, going in 4 years' time from having the cheapest electricity in South Africa to having the most expensive electricity. Just a breakdown of our cost drivers, the pie chart that I showed you earlier, just going back a little bit in history, just see how that has changed with time, to really understand what the impact of the electricity increases has been for Siltec. If you go right down to the left of the chart there, you can see in 2007, the proportion of electricity of our total cost of production has been about 28.7%. That has increased this year to 43.4%. I projected it forward at a rate of 16%, which we've learned today is not the correct number, as industry will really see an increase of 20%, not 16%. But anyway, projected forward to 2015, we will see that electricity, if we were still in operation, would make up almost 50% of our cost of production. What I've done here is I went back to 2007 and did a little bit of a what-if exercise. I said, what if the increases that we've seen over the past couple of years has not been the exorbitant numbers that we've seen, but it's only been 15% year on year? And I put that into my model, recalculated my cost of production, recalculated the proportion of electricity cost as a portion of our cost production, and displayed it on the graph here. And I think the chart certainly speaks for itself. You can see that electricity has been 28.7% of our total cost of production in 2007, would have increased to about 32% this year, and further increased to about 37% in 2015. Comparing that to the cost of raw materials, which would have more or less stayed on the same kind of number, 33%. So as I said, I think this chart certainly speaks for itself. What is the real values of the cost of electricity for Siltec in terms of real monetary values? And I apologize for this table. I have not updated it. I've used it in a presentation that I've made to Eskom last year. I couldn't find the origin of this, but I am going to use it nonetheless. What I've done here, right at the left-hand side there is a year, and then you can see the actual tons produced for each specific year. You can see then for 2007 we produced about 47,000 tons. 2008, there was a period after the global financial crisis when we suspended the operation of one furnace as well, reduction down to about 43,000 tons. And so the numbers more or less varies around about 44,000, 45,000 tons. The cost of electricity, the increases, you can see there what electricity has actually cost us on an annual basis. In 2007, electricity cost us 77 million rand. Last year, projected would have been 206 million rand. And if we were still in operation this year, the projected cost would have been in order of 242 million rand. Just highlighting my argument that electricity for South Celtic has literally tripled. An important thing to also take from this table here is what the cost of the rural subsidies and environmental levies is. These are levies that we pay on our actual consumption of electricity. And you can see what the numbers are. It has increased from 7.9 million rand in 2007. Projected number this year would have been 32 million rand. And right, compare that to our net profit after tax. Now, in all due respect, 2007, 2008, everybody has seen the commodities boom, and everybody made a hell of a profit during those years. Fortunately, Celtic made some good profits as well, and we were able to pay that out as dividends for the first time to our shareholders. But compare the numbers in 2009-2010 against the subsidies that we were paying. In 2010, we were paying 32 million rand in terms of subsidies and making a profit of 22 million after tax. Last year, we made a profit of 13 million while paying a profit of 27 million, making a profit of 13 million while paying subsidies and levies of 27 million. This year, for obvious reasons, we suspended our operation because we were not going to make a profit, but if we were, we would probably be paying in order of 32 million rand in terms of subsidies and levies. I'll get you back to this later. It's quite exorbitant numbers. This is another what-if exercise. What I've done here is the two rather flexible lines on the chart there. There's a blue one and a red one. The blue one is imported parity from China. That is basically the ceiling to what we can increase our pricing here locally in South Africa. You can only increase the price up until to the point where it starts making sense for your consumer ArcelorMittal, for instance, to start importing on their own from China. So import parity is a good, it's always been a very good base for setting price in South Africa. And then I showed you earlier, 30% of our production has to be exported. So export parity to Europe has been the other important factor when you consider what kind of revenue you make on the material that you export. You can see there, obviously, the line is rather wavy and flexible, going up and down as the market waxes and wanes. In 2008, very good period. Everybody made good profits. Then the market crashed after that, and the prices came down, recovered a bit in 2010, and now with the problems that we are experiencing in Europe, softening again. The straight purple line is our actual production cost. The purple stepped line, that's our actual production cost average for a year that I've just drawn against the flexibility variance in the market pricing for ferrosilicon. And you can see there, margins has never been really very big for ferrosilicon apart from the period in 2008. But nonetheless, we were in a position to make a bit of profit. I'm going to see if I can get this period here. You can see 2011 last year, because of the strong rand. The rand was, I think, was at that time trading around about 6.75. Import parity really was an alternative, and we did see some material being imported into ferrosilicon and actually replacing our product. And we still could, at that time, pricing in Europe was still fairly strong, so we could still export to Europe, make a bit of profit, an locally was very difficult competing. Then the pricing came down. I will get to this later as well, but at this time we decided to suspend the operation of one phone, one of our furnaces. And you can see what has happened with the pricing going forward in Europe this year. Even with the softening of the rand, the pricing has softened by more than 30%, and export material is not, export sales not been profitable. And you can see even local sales are only marginally profitable if you're really lucky to do that. The green line here is, again, my what-if exercise. What I've done here, again, I said, what if electricity only increased by 15% instead of the numbers that we've seen? And again, the chart really speaks for itself. You can see here very clearly that if electricity has only increased by 15% instead of the numbers that we've seen, that the margins would more or less have stayed in the regions that we have been accustomed in the past couple of years. And most probably Siltec would still have been in operation. Just the events of this year, maybe I should just go back a little bit earlier. At the end of 2010, when I submitted my budget to our board, I already sensitized them at that stage that Siltec is going to have a very difficult period of operation in 2011. First board meeting last year, we decided to investigate alternatives for the company. I personally run models for the production of ferrochrome, ferromanganese, silicon manganese. And I know the question was asked earlier, why is chrome ore exported and not produced locally? As I said, I run the models for ferrochrome, and our plant ferrochrome was not making sense. Okay, obviously there's a lot of issues here. The furnace is not really the ideal kind of furnace for the production of ferrosilicon. We would have to buy material in, ore in from producers. And also, I think we're a little bit out of the way in terms of the volume of material that has to be transported to Siltec. But nonetheless, doing the models for ferrochrome, ferromanganese, and silicon manganese did not make sense. We also, basically, second board meeting that we had last year, we decided to suspend the operation of one furnace. I illustrated to you earlier that roughly 60% of our product had to be exported. And based on that, we said that we are going to go into negative cash flow if we continue operation. So we decided to suspend the operation of one furnace last year. And then in the third board meeting we had last year, I basically demonstrated to our board that we will not be profitable going into 2012. And the decision was taken that the second furnace will also be suspended after the increases that we've seen in April. In January, Eskom came with the buyback arrangements, and at that stage, both furnaces were still operating. We decided to sell back our electricity to Eskom, and when the buyback arrangement ran out at the end of May, we basically just decided to exercise the decisions that was taken last year already on board level to suspend the operation. So the operation of both furnaces has been in suspension since February. We've given everybody notice. Everybody has been retained in terms of the Section 289 Labor Relations Act regulations. Currently, we have a couple of about 2,000 tons of ferrosilicon still on site, which we are liquidating in order to turn out the working capital to our board, to our shareholders. And as of the end of the year, there will really just be nothing going on the site. Maybe keep the plant in care and maintenance, with a complement of four people. That's basically the plan with the site. So all in all, the impact on labour, I just have a copy there of our Employment Equity Act submissions, about 264 employees that have been affected. And you can see there on the bottom section there about 160 on the lower skilled people, maybe even more close to 200 lower skilled people that's really been affected by this move.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Morkel. And so, to just get it quite clear, are you suggesting... Could you turn that off? Are you suggesting or trying to convey to us that you will be suspending the operation entirely at the end of the year? I just want to clarify that.
No, that's not correct. The operation has already been suspended. It's been in suspension since February. And we just confirmed that decision after the buyback arrangement ran out at the end of May. And everybody has already been retrenched. We're just winding down the business, and as of next year, the business will be in care maintenance.
Thank you very much. Members, it's over to you for questions and comment.
Madam Chair.
I'm going to start recognising you. Honourable McIntosh, Honourable van der Merwe.
Madam Chair, I just want to say that, again, another very good presentation, also depressing. I think the most interesting slide was those purple and green lines, which is your profitability one. That one. And, you know, that's in a sense the issue, Madam Chair. If we want to compete with China, and we can compete with China, and it's been demonstrated that we have the skills and a competent manager like Mr. Morkel, obviously is one, an example. You know, business can't run at a loss. And now 260 people have lost their jobs as a result of an operation like this. I do have one question. Where you had that other graph showing how much electricity you need to produce a ton, you had two graphs either side. They were bar charts further back. Yeah, that one. One of the issues, and you mentioned their name, is Billiton's Alusaf investment in Richards Bay. Is that Billiton?
I did mention BHP Billiton, but it's not the Alusaf operation. It's the operation, silicon manganese operation at Metalloys.
Yes, I know that, and a different one. Madam Chair, the question is, if one put in the aluminium smelting cost in that graph, how much electricity does it require to in megawatt hours per ton to produce those solid blocks of aluminium that one sees moving down the highways of Natal?
Thank you very much. Honourable van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair, and we really will be quite suicidal by the time we finish here today because it's all very bad news. My question is, who are your customers going to buy their stuff from now? And second of all, is there any hope that the plant can be revived? In other words, as the major input cost, if the electricity price were reduced miraculously, which we know have no power to do, let me say, but if it were reduced, would the business then become viable again, and could you take it out of suspension and start it again?
I have a couple of questions myself. Now, you have tried to show the committee that the electricity costs seem to be one of the significant inputs, but it would be constructive for us as well to get a breakdown of your input costs that existed last year, as it were, prior to you closing down. Wages, X, etc., etc., etc. Just a clarification on that, you see. And then, as you pointed out earlier, the cost of electricity then 2010 with all those costs, and the cost of electricity now. So we could get a clear understanding of the significance of that cost. The second point, though, as well, is just clarification, Mr. Morkel. There's a map here prior to one of the aerial views. It's not really numbered, but there you've got a map and you've got numbers on that map, and then, you know, almost like a light bulb showing Newcastle, as it were. What 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, what do they represent? It would appear to me as if along the line, and I know some of them do appear to be involved in having found lease, etc., but if you could make that clear as to what that represents to for us. And the other aspect here, you spoke about the parity here, and it would be useful to know what discussions you may have had in this regard with, I think it is Economic Development, but I stand correct to correction here, who at one stage, and the DDG may know this as well from GTI, the distressed companies, there was some allocation to them forthcoming from, I think, or through the Economic Development Department. And I'm not sure if you had access to that, if you knew about it, or whether in fact you did make application, and just how effective or successful or unsuccessful, whatever it was. And then the third point here, you mentioned about the closing down of Findry, staggering this, you know, one and then another, etc. How many of these, sorry, not foundries, furnaces do you actually have? And, you know, was there no way of continuing in a viable manner with 50% of them, if you'd let me know how many furnaces you've got, and to see just what could be done? Because I understand, looking my recollections about the area you're speaking, Newcastle, etc., is that if one wouldn't want to lose that number, or rather to add that number of workers to the unemployment curve at all. So it would be useful to see what plans you had taken with government, if you like, with the different departments to try and prevent that, and having exhausted them, where are we now? If that's quite clear. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try and answer the questions. First of all, to Honourable McIntosh. In terms of the megawatt hour per ton you require for the production of aluminium, I know it's higher than for silicon metal, but I'm not sure what the exact number is. I apologize for that. In terms of who our customers are and where they will be getting their supply from, some of them will certainly be supplied from, there's another local producer, Rand Carbide, sitting in Witbank, will probably be supplied by them. But I also know that some of them have already tested the waters and are looking at securing their supply from imports. So it's a question where it will be coming from. In terms of can the plant be started up again if electricity does come down, certainly that's our intention. We are putting the plant in care and maintenance, and we will have one person left on site just to keep an eye on the site. So if something miraculously does happen, and pricing for electricity does come down, we will be able to start up the plant again. Madam Chair, just in terms of your questions, you've asked for a breakdown of cost. Do you want me to submit in writing? Okay, I can do that to, I assume, to the secretary. Right. Okay. Going back to the map, I'm just going to see if I can find that. The numbers that you see there is really the N3, the N11, the N12, all the national roads. It's really just a copy and paste exercise from Garmin Map. In terms of the discussions that we've had, yes, I personally have had quite a number of discussions with various state departments. I wrote letters to DTI, I wrote letters to DPE, to DEE, even to Eskom, asking them, explaining our situation since the middle of last year, telling them that we are going to run into trouble, that we probably will be forced to close down. We had a high-level delegation from Eskom on our side, and I explained, as I said, this specific presentation was actually prepared for them, just explaining what our situation was. And I just want to move again onto a slide just to explain to you what I've told them. Just going back to this slide on the rural subsidies and environmental levies, one of the questions and requests that I posed to the various departments as well as Eskom is, can't we get a rebate on the levies, on the subsidies and levies? If we could get, if I was going to stop my operation anyway, I would be stopping to pay that levies, and they would anyway lose that. if we were to get a rebate on that, we could possibly continue to operate maybe for another year or so, continue to provide employment, continue to pay taxes. And needless to say, the answer to that was a negative. In terms of the possible financial help for companies in distress, I want to make it clear that, I mean, the decision for us to stop our operation was not because we had debt. Siltec was debt-free for the past couple of years. The decision is purely based on the premise that if we were to continue operation, we would certainly be wiping out value, destroying value for the shareholders. To go and make debt to try and see it through would certainly not make sense, because there's just no way that you can live yourself and operate yourself out of debt. So, yes, we have spoken to the various departments, but that wasn't an option for us. In terms of the number of furnaces that we have, we've got two furnaces, furnace A and B, as I indicated earlier. At one stage last year, we considered operating only one furnace, and we actually gave notice to our employees that we are going to go through a retrenchment exercise and reduce our operation by 50%. But even the operation of the remaining furnace became unprofitable, and the decision was then taken to suspend the operation of both of them.
Thank you very much. Yes, Anna. Thank you very much. Just in that interruption, I forget someone's name. Mr. Morkel. Now, I did see the hand, but it was the jerk on my left that cost me my memory. No, thank you. Mr. Strachan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to answer the...
I don't speak slang.
Madam Chair, just to answer the IDC in terms of the framework response to the global crisis, set aside 7 billion rand. I speak under correction, but I'm reasonably certain that of that, 4.8 billion has been dispersed to 108 companies. The only question that you should bear in mind, perhaps, is that this is not grant funding. Essentially, it's loan finance, and the IDC would be very reluctant to provide funding to companies whose cost structure means that they're unsustainable in the long term because of the impact of, amongst other things, the sharply escalating electricity prices.
Well, what I'd also appreciate then, Mr. Morkel, is you spoke about this levy arrangement, etc. Put that in writing so we have a clear understanding of it, And then, yes, we will come back to you. I'm sure that you'll still be around at that company during November, won't you? Thank you. So thank you to you, Mr. Morkel. We're very pleased you took the opportunity to share this with us. And let's see what can be done. And I'm also very happy that Eskom have stayed behind, broadly speaking, that is, as well as NERSA, and I know the department is still here with us as well. And let's move on then. You see, you interrupt me like that. Score medals. Then jerk me around. I'm sure we all enjoyed the laugh. Right. Then we've got score medals, Mr. Simonson, Group Development Manager, right? And your colleague on your left.
My colleague is
Sorry. No, I'm front.
It's not fronting, is it? I mean, I don't know.
My colleague is Livu Magadimisa. He's the energy manager from School Metals, recently appointed in the last 3 months, I think, yeah. this is the first time we're working together because it's quite a large project.
Over to you as soon as the laptop's on the go. Tell me you're working with a laptop, is it?
No. Find the presentation.
That is more or less the structure of School Metals. We employ 6,500 people at the moment. It's down a bit from we've shed about 1,000 jobs over the last 5 years for a variety of reasons. We definitely can't blame it all on electricity. Our melting divisions, which you see at the top, the scrap processing division and rolled products division, they're producing the hot rolled materials which feed into our grinding media businesses and into our wire rod products business. And the wire rod products business, we basically beneficiate sort of 40% of the products we produce are beneficiated products from hot products. We recycle, importantly, we recycle about 500,000 tons of scrap steel per year. This is quite a busy slide, and I'm not going to go through it in detail, but it's just saying SCORE, we are involved with several government initiatives. There's a beneficiation framework which we work through. IPAP is policies which we have been engaged with. There's possible amendments to the MPRDA, Mineral Petroleum Resources Development Act, which where we're hoping to make provisions for a new beneficiation framework. As a business, we are based basically in South Africa, selling into Africa. We have some operations in Australia and distribution in Australia. We have a small technical small ownership of a business in Italy, but basically we're a South African business selling into South Africa and Africa. What's important and what we're going to talk through today is that most of our South African operations are all based in Gauteng. We have a distribution network around the country, as you can see, from Cape Town and Port Elizabeth up to Kuruman, Newcastle, Richards Bay, but our manufacturing base is based in Gauteng. And within Gauteng, our Union Junction operation is supplied by Eskom at Megaflex rates. Our other operations largely, in fact almost entirely, are supplied by municipalities and by a number of municipalities. Our Germiston operation is supplied by the city of Johannesburg. Vereeniging, our chain plant in Vereeniging, supplied by the Mpulweni municipality. Our operation operations on the East Rand are all supplied by Ekurhuleni. Which brings me to a slide which is not too different to some other slides you've seen today. We're seeing in Johannesburg an 81% markup on the Megaflex tariff. If we were supplied by Eskom, you'll see on the slide that we'd be paying for our operation in Johannesburg 22 million rand a year. Because we have the pleasure of being supplied by the city of Johannesburg, we pay close on 39 million. This is a bit of a problem, and the question we ask ourselves is, you know, the large municipalities that you see there, sort of Johannesburg and Mpulweni, should have economies of scale. They should actually be logically supplying us at rates which are cheaper than municipalities like Durban, where there's only a 28% markup on industrial tariffs. We have a factory in Durban producing sisal ropes, and we're very fortunate to be supplied at those tariffs there because it's a marginal operation. Another problem which has been raised today as well is if you look at the demand charge portion of the electrical tariff, we are paying roughly half of our electrical bill is a maximum demand tariff, and the other half is an energy tariff. And within the municipalities, there are massive markups on the maximum demand charge. And I know it was raised today that the question of where does the 700% markup come from? And if you look at the markup we're paying in Johannesburg, we're paying between 133 and 140 rand per kVA, which is four times what we'd be paying if we were fed by Eskom. And that's the problem with the maximum demand charges are a couple. One, it disincentivizes energy saving. We've got foundries where our volumes have dropped dramatically and our electricity bill has only dropped by a small amount because we're still paying a very high fixed demand charge, or maximum demand charge. Our proposal is that these charges need to be reduced. If nothing else, they at least need to be capped and prevented from growing any further. And we also feel that these demand charges, which are really related to the size of your installation, that the money that or the revenue that flows from them should be used for infrastructure upgrade of the municipal distribution networks, which we know is a problem with municipalities in that their infrastructure is not being upgraded and replaced. Taking you through to this, this is a view of our recent past. I understood that we needed to show you, give you an idea of our input costs beyond only electricity. The green line at 14% is our increase in labour charges. All these costs are costs per ton rebased to a number of 100. So everything increases in the slide from 100. Our labour's increased 14% over. This is a 14% per year, so it's a consolidated annual growth rate of 14% per year. Our gas has increased by 5%. We're supplied by Sasol Gas, not from the municipality. Our total conversion cost has grown by 11%, so that's our cost to take steel and turn it into a finished product. Whilst our selling price has only grown by 3.5%, that's the dotted line at the bottom. Part of that is because we came off quite a high base in 2008, 2009. And against that you see the electricity, which has risen by 26%. In some operations, that electricity we're able to absorb some of those increases, but in this operation, a lot of the margins are quite small. You're trying to produce high volumes on fairly small margins, and when you have big increases like a 26% per annum increase, it affects your profitability quite heavily. This is a picture the way we see our prices going forward. The green line, which you see at the bottom, that's the Eskom Megaflex rate increasing at the percentage that the municipality, that Eskom has presented in their multi-year price determination recently. It starts off at 13%. It's a 13% increase coming up. It's then an 18%, 18%, 18%, and 19%, which overall sees us seeing our electricity increase by 22% on an annual basis. Now that's different to what Eskom presented in their slide, because they showed only the increase for the 2012-13 year, and they said municipalities will see a 13% increase. But going forward, their price path is actually jumping up to the order of 18%. Now, if we were supplied by Eskom, if we were on that green line at the bottom, we would probably cope with those increases. But if those increases are applied directly to the municipal tariff, like they have been until very recently, and we see the bulk of those increases, our price path will be that red line at the top. We'll move from paying 40 million rand a year to the city of Johannesburg to paying close on about 18, 19 million rand a year. Now, for the size of that operation, it's a cash flow, a cash outflow that we just can't sustain. What it means is that business won't close, but all the products which are marginal, have marginal contributions, are going to be put at risk. We've already in this operation had to reduce our labor. We've had to cut back on some of the products we manufacture. We're in the process at the moment of retrenching about 200 odd people. If those prices which we see in the red line at the top come to fruition, we will probably see further retrenchments in the process of the next 5 years. Like I say, our business will still exist in 10 years' time or 5 years' time, but it will be manufacturing only the very high margin large products. We won't be competitive on some of the products which we are competitive on at the moment. It's no good coming here with only complaints. These are the suggestions which we can make from our perspective. It's quite obvious that municipalities need to improve their revenue collection. Johannesburg has in 2010-11, their financial reports mentioned that they had technical and non-technical losses of 20%. I know that they're going to be presenting to NERSA on how they intend bringing that percentage down. Cross-subsidization needs to be, we need to look at. It's very rough on industry to be asked to pay for everything via the electricity tariff. I know it's a big problem to fix. I know it involves many different parts of government, from South African, you know, from the SOLGA to the Treasury, but it needs to be looked at. And then the cost of supply, there's another problem which for some reason I haven't seen come up, and maybe Eskom is beginning to look at addressing it. The municipality buys electrical power at the megaflex rate. It's okay, it's a municipal megaflex rate, but it's more or less identical to the industrial megaflex rate. So if we as an industrial consumer are to say to the municipalities, please supply us power at the same price as what Eskom can supply us power, the only way the municipality can do that is to supply it to us with either 0% markup or in some cases a very small loss. The municipalities need to be supplied at a wholesale rate that is lower than the industrial rate. Otherwise, they simply cannot supply industry at a competitive rate, no matter what they do. And that's something we feel needs to be urgently looked at. Our alternatives are not really viable alternatives. I mean, the one option is to try and supply some of our businesses directly from Eskom. It is possible in some cases. It's almost impossible in other cases. And we feel there's a need for municipalities to start looking at how energy can be wheeled through to consumers, so that if we do have access to electricity at a cheaper rate, we can try and bring it through to these businesses. As part of the scope for today, I understood that you were interested in, the members were interested in opportunities for local sourcing. Now, although we're not going to say, look, we don't want orders from government, long term, we need to be sustainable. We need to have business fundamentals in place which can ensure that we can sell internationally and locally competitively. And certainly in the best interest of government, we need to be able to supply it at competitive rates. The areas where there are opportunities is in terms of the rail business. The score foundries have been historically based on a large supply of bogies and wheels to the rail industry in South Africa. Almost every bogie on trains in South Africa was manufactured by a score at some time in its history. We have spare capacity there. We have the desire to invest in new technology to bring our costs down and to produce better quality products. We need the visibility on what needs to be done and produced by when. Moving on to other areas, the Eskom build program is bringing in a lot of transmission lines. We produce the steel wire ropes, steel strand which goes into the middle of those overhead power lines. And our only dilemma there is we produce that product at the moment, but if there are very large volumes which Eskom would like to produce, it will help enormously if we had some visibility of what they want and when they want it by, and if we could enter into sort of long-term contracts which would allow us to make investments which can bring costs down and provide a product to Eskom at a better price. Without that forward visibility, it's very difficult to make business decisions. The infrastructure process, which I know has been in the news a lot recently with Marion Roberts, those tenders haven't aren't coming through to the civil industry, and us and the entire steel industry supply steel to the civil industry. So when they see their work pick up, we will see work in the steel businesses pick up. And then lastly, we continue to supply grinding media to Eskom, and that's a positive part. The next slide is, you might say to me, is a little bit out of place in this presentation. But basically, if you're looking at a stimulus for the steel industry, an export steel tariff is something that needs to be seriously looked at. These tariffs are not uncommon. China has a 40% tariff on scrap steel exports. India has a 15% tariff. Argentina, 20%. Zambia has completely banned the export of steel scrap. Now, what you need to remember is that steel is made with basically three things. You need coal, you need electricity, and you need iron ore. And when you're exporting steel scrap, you're exporting electricity, you're exporting 500 kilowatt hours per ton of electricity, and most of that steel was manufactured with very cheap electricity in the past. You're exporting cheap electricity, you're exporting coal and iron ore, which has been beneficiated. You're exporting to countries like China and India. Even a small tariff of 15% can have an enormous stimulus to the steel industry, to everybody who's melting and producing steel products. And I think it's also true for the aluminium industry. It makes them considerably more competitive, and it will assist stimulate those industries. To give you an idea, the export of scrap since 2006 has grown at a rate of 22% per annum. At a rate which is 22% annualized, and whilst the beneficiation of steel scrap has dropped by 3% per annum. So we are basically deindustrializing our country. And we also view steel scrap as a national resource. It's something which is hard to find around the world. And South Africa at the moment is a very good source of that scrap for all of our competitors. In terms of our recommendations, one of our prime things is we do need to see the municipal tariffs normalized. We've mentioned the three key things which we think need to be addressed. The municipalities need a wholesale tariff on electricity, which is going to allow them to provide suppliers competitively. We need to improve municipal revenue collection. We need to try and reduce this cross-subsidization of services. In the long term, if municipal tariffs remain at the levels where they are, our industries which are fed by those municipalities will become increasingly uncompetitive and will ultimately close down. And certainly new investment is going to be very difficult to justify in an area that's fed by a municipality. We will only largely be able to justify investments in areas which are fed by Eskom at the moment. The localization, certainly there's been a lot of good work done by government, and we'd like to engage and assist in continuing that work, because it is better that we can assist and produce something in South Africa rather than it's produced by our competitors. And then the last thing which we've just covered is if consideration could be given to the steel scrap export tariff, it would stimulate the steel industries tremendously. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's Mr. Simonson.
That's correct, Mr. Simonson.
Right, and your colleague, Majidimisa. Thank you.
That's correct.
Members, I'm very pleased to have had some of the suggestions that have come forward here. I must share that with you myself. But also some of the recommendations. But let me allow members to comment. If you just turn your own mic off, please. comment and raise questions, please. Yes, Honourable Van der Merwe.
Thanks. I wanted to just make two comments. I think the scrap metal issue is one that has been drawn to our attention, and it's something that has been drawn to our attention directly by the DTI. And so I think work will be done in that regard, because that is a sort of a no-brainer. Also on the municipal tariffs, I think that's quite a useful suggestion to say, well, Eskom should be rather dealing with the cost of which they supply the municipalities, and then that will give a bit of flexibility. But I think the problem is much greater, because if they are recouping 60% of their budgets and more from this electricity, it's not going to be easy to cut that supply. So, I mean, you obviously have talked about the improvement of revenue collection, but I think we've got a very large problem. The point is, I think we have to look at just capping it at some point and balancing out, so that into the future we can have a different scenario with those increases that they are proposing over and above. But those are just comments. Thank you, Chair.
I think you've heard those comments, generally speaking. Are there any other comments or questions in this regard? Honourable McIntosh?
Madam Chair, again, thank you for a presentation, this time from a really big boy in the manufacturing, and with a long, long history behind SCORE before it was SCORE, in developing and growing South Africa. On the scrap metal, a comment and really partly a question to the DTI. I'm a farmer in KwaZulu-Natal, and I can tell you, I don't know how the guys in the scrap metal world work, but they've managed to build up a network of people which is much better than Tupperware. They get around to get scrap metal everywhere. And in fact, it's a problem on some of the farms. I mean, people are stealing fencing material and all kinds of stuff. And when you make inquiries, it's all going to the scrap metal dealers. And we see down that hell run that the N3 has become with all the lorries that are moving. You see these lorries loaded, huge trucks full of scrap metal. So I identify that, but my question to, and it's partly to the chairman of the committee and to the department, is I am aware of people saying there should be a tariff on scrap metal exports. I thought nothing had happened for the last year or two because DTI was so committed to laissez-faire free market principles that it wouldn't impose them. But, I mean, we now discover that we're not going to have a problem because other countries put tariffs on exporting. And so it's not a question of that. It's a question of protecting our interests. And my question is, why haven't we? I mean, it's the Minister of Department of Trade and Industries, you should put it, call for a tariff. And as my colleague, Honourable Van der Merwe, said, it's a no-brainer. It just means somebody's got to, do some work.
Well, I just wanted to raise something myself, if you don't mind, and then do come in, Mr. Strachan. One of the things here I noticed, you were talking about opportunities for local sourcing, leveraging localization in the following products, and you're calling railway wheels, etc., etc. Certainly, I'm sure DTI would confirm this, that we are ourselves, supporting localization, increased localization, and you probably are aware of this yourself. So I was quite heartened when you saw that as opportunities, notwithstanding XYZ. You made it clear you would not close down. This would not lead to closure. It may lead to one or two other issues happening. But then you did refer to a number of opportunities, and I was very impressed by that approach.
But I was really quite interested when you were putting yourselves in the boots of the municipalities, as it were, and making suggestions as to how they could possibly look at this if Eskom did X, Y, Z, essentially to provide electricity to the municipalities at a lower than Megaflex rate, by the sound of it. I'm sure some Eskom people are still here and would pass that one on. So I think, you know, that kind of thing could be looked at, obviously. The localization I've already spoken about. But I know that the government has raised this issue of scrap. If I'm not mistaken, not allowed to export it as scrap or something like that, because one was finding one's car exported as scrap or something. Not quite. But, you know, it was getting quite alarming as to what people thought they could export as scrap under guise of even possibly score metals. But let me allow Mr. Strachan to come in first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly will pass on to the Minister, Dr. Davies, the characterization of laissez-faire free marketeers. But leave that aside. Madam Chairperson, the function for an export tax lies with the National Treasury. The DTI has motivated for an export tax for the reasons set out in the presentation from Score Metals. In fact, that was turned down. We have pursued under my colleague Tandi Pele, who's the head of the Metals Fabrication, Capital and Transport Equipment sector. She's the chief director, an alternative mechanism. I can't provide any detail on that because it is going before Cabinet shortly, but I think there will be a significant progress in that regard in the very near future. Other than what's been said out here, Madam Chair, I think the one thing that hasn't been mentioned is that the export of scrap metal very often, apart from being associated with crime in other respects, is also associated with masking the export of precious metals, and there was a recent case where in fact it was masking the export of metals with a way above statutory requirement for radioactivity. We really are mindful of this instrument, which has not hitherto been deployed and hopefully will be deployed in the very near future.
Thank you very much, Mr. Strachan. Over to you then, Score Metal.
Yes, certainly the scrap, I understand the laissez-faire principle of saying, well, look, if we're going to have an open economy, we can't have tariffs on scrap exports. But unfortunately, we are competing with countries that aren't entirely open. The playing fields are not level. I'm not an expert on the scrap metal issue. Certainly, if this committee and wants to engage with SCORE, there are people at SCORE who are far more clued up than I am, and we can answer any questions on that in writing as well. But generally what we're doing is as businesses, especially the marginal part of our businesses, we're running into problems where we're running out of competitive advantages. And that's really the bottom line. You know, electricity used to be a competitive advantage. It still is to some extent in some businesses, but in other businesses, which are fed by municipalities at very high rates, it's not. You've also got to remember some of our businesses are competing within South Africa with other businesses not owned by us, and they might be, in some cases, supplied at an Eskom rate, whereas our equivalent business is not supplied at an Eskom rate. And that's, it makes it difficult.
Yeah. If I can just add to what you were saying on scrap, I mean, we've had a look at this a bit. You'll find that countries like India, for example, or Indian, some of the Indian importers are able to buy scrap at a higher price. They afford to pay higher prices for scrap in the country than we're able to. So, and they still have to export that. And because their economies have been protected, you get into that situation where they can actually come and you actually run out of scrap. And one of our alternatives when we don't have enough scrap, we have to produce, you know, get the iron from iron ore, which means we have to run a DRI kilns, which requires a lot more energy than, you know, so it's a double whammy. If we, the scrap is getting exported, we need to produce, get the iron from raw iron ore, and then we have to spend more electricity. And if you, with where the electricity prices are going, you can see what the challenge is.
Sorry, and one other thing on the scrap, which is like Lee was just mentioned, Score Metals has the facility to produce its own pig iron from iron ore, coal and electricity, but a lot of small foundries, the mom-and-pop type operations which employ maybe 50 or 100 people are producing, you know, small specialized castings, they can't easily just switch to producing their own pig iron. They need to buy steel scrap. That's their raw input. And when that price climbs, because we're a cheap source of scrap for countries around, other countries in the world, it's a bit of a problem. And my understanding of why some of those countries can afford to buy from us is also that they have, for example, they might have export incentives which allow them to, for example, sell back into South Africa, because they've got an export incentive from their country. So it's quite complicated, but it's the bottom line is it's hurting our steel industry.
Well, we certainly do hear that, but I think the department is aware of that, and government at large, as you know yourself, having put the banning, as far as I'm aware, am I right, Mr. Strachan, people are now, that's been stopped, hasn't it, this easy export of scrap metal.
Madam Chair, it's nothing's been done at the moment. As I said, the application for a tax on scrap metal was put to the National Treasury and turned down. But we are very far advanced at looking at another instrument which is going before Cabinet and hopefully will be signed off and deployed in the very near future.
That's fine. So we'll explore that ourselves in our report, because we don't want that going out. And I think people are mindful of why DTI has raised this particular issue.
Well, we've had a very, very, I think, constructive day here. Had a number of companies who've shared with us their challenges, and also I was very happy to see that nurses stayed the course, as did Eskom, because in the end this is the key issue of this year's IPAP public hearings, and it would be premature for us to give you an shooting off the hip comment or anything as to where we are. The committee will want to study all the inputs. We have already asked NERSA and Eskom to return to us, if you recall, once you have also benefited from this engagement. And what we are looking at, and I say that and the committee secretary will confirm it, is that it's next, what is it, the 21st. On Wednesday, the 21st of November, and perhaps you would, Mr. Brian Dalmers may well be back from China. I don't see him staying out 3 weeks. That he would be able to be here as well as is it Miss Inzimande from NERSA. So we do hope that you'll be able to bring those back. You will share with them what you've got now, and if there's someone you could leave with us on the days that we are conducting these IPAP hearings, and we are looking at Wednesday the 7th, and you will make this, I'm sure, schedule available, and Friday the 9th, which ends at 2:30, and then again Wednesday, no, we're not doing it on Wednesday the 14th. So, as I've just indicated, we would then have, I see on the Friday the 16th, there's a consideration of the first draft, but we will change that. I'm surprised we didn't choose Friday the 16th then. So we may well do that for the early morning. So it's either going to be the 16th or the 21st, and the Portfolio Committee Secretary will confirm this and make the schedules available to you as to who is going to come here. And what we'll also do then, members of the committee, is I think it's been constructive when some of those making an input have made it very clear some of their suggestions and recommendations, because you see it's one thing here to just mention the challenges, and have a little creed occur about it. On the other hand, we would like all of those making inputs to share with us how they have thought about resolving the matter themselves, and to share with us some of these recommendations that they can be aired in public at this, on this platform. So I think that was a very good start in that direction. Thank you. And to the committee, you're aware then of some of the changes. I want to thank you. I know it hasn't been easy. You are committed in other meetings as well. But I hope we will see everyone then on Wednesday. And everyone here, what is it? Is that Wednesday the 9th, is it, or 7th? Wednesday the 7th, and that is the old Assembly Chamber. Thank you very much.